Dave Max Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
John Creedon, I've been looking to get you out here for a chat for quite some time. We have you finally, but we have you slightly under the weather.
Feeling fine, but as...
Looking fine.
As croaky.
More importantly.
I wish. You can't see the haircut on radio, no? Good. Doing fine. Got a bit of a croak, but I think everybody...
And the lesson of the hair is, before you use the bazzer, check the setting on the yoke.
No, check you've got the yoke on it. Honestly, my raid went straight for skinhead and then realised, oh no, I forgot to put the number 2, 3, 4 or 5 on it.
Luckily, you're largely a radio man, although actually there's a fair bit of TV and that's what we're about to, well, we'll get to. But I want to talk about, you're an author now, John.
Author, God, yeah.
An author.
So was Arthur Daly, wasn't it?
Ooh, Arthur Daly, indeed. The second book, which is flying off the shelves all over Christmas, is A Treasury of Irish Folklore. Let's start with that, and I know we're going to rove wildly and widely.
Never know what would happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm familiar with... So, what did it lead on from the first book, or is it completely separate? And what is it that led you to do this? Explain the background to A Treasury of Irish Folklore. I'm familiar with this and it's a fascinating thing.
Okay. It led on from the first book, I think, in the publisher's head. Because...
Which was That Place We Call Home.
That Place We Call Home. I'd been asked by Gill on a number of occasions if I'd write something. They felt there was a book in me. They were convinced there was a book in me. And I'm saying, yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I've written comedy. I've written features. I've written the occasional newspaper article, but I'm not sure I could do a book. And they said, would you not do a love letter to Ireland? And I said, yeah, that's a bit grand for someone like me. And they came back and came back. And eventually I said, you know what? I said, place names has a particular place for me. Huge growth for place names. Got that from my dad, I suppose. Inchigeela, all the beautiful place names around there. Tearness, Bidoiga, the land of the robins, Kamini, the leap or the path.
And had you always that?
Only from sitting in the passenger seat listening to my dad.
But from childhood, an awareness of a story behind a story.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is amazing. Rory Cobb, one of the TV producers I work with, said to me, he said, I hadn't the slightest interest in place names until I met you. Yeah. Now I'm driving around town going, Umvar Avenue, where the Pic du Jard Park, what the hell's that about? Yeah. So there is a story behind, they're all labels.
Well, it's actually drawn me back into the language place names.
Yeah.
Just that. Do you know what? I actually did translations, Brian Friel's play as Leaving Cert, and that planted some sort of a seed that's come to fruition over the years of that sense of the story behind the story, the Idjarga scale to between two stories as we are as Irish people on this island. And that sense of the English name means nothing, really. It's just an approximation. Often, more often than not, it's an approximation of a Gaelic name that has a meaning. It has a place in the landscape or in something that's more real than the English version. It drew me in. If you're
getting
me
going already, I can think of two crackers. Long before I did the book or got into the academic side of it, I always had that growth for place names. And travelling around in the car with my partner Mairead, we'd always have the old folklore, the little Irish dictionary inside in the glove box. And one day we were diverted. The Cork Middleton Road, there was very heavy flooding. Road was impassable in parts. We were asked to divert around Mogili. And Mairead said to me, Mogili. I said, yeah, that sounds like something from the Jungle Book. She said, what does it mean? And I said, God, I don't know. I said, the ma. Usually when you see a ma means a maw, M-A-I-G-H, as
a plane.
Mallow, yeah. And more often than not, a floodplain, because it's such a wet country that when you've got flat land, usually there's a stream trickling through it that perhaps
becomes... In this case, it's not. It's a saint, is it?
No.
In this case, it is.
It is plain, the same as Mayo, Mayo.
The plain of the yew tree.
My kind of guy. So I thought...
And yokel.
Yokel, there's another one, yew trees again, But anyway, I thought to myself, Maw Gili, so the Maw bit is probably a plain or a floodplain. Gila, God, I don't know, look up G-I for the L-E, because it's given in the English on the signpost, G-E-E-L-Y or something. I said, look up G-I for the L-E in the folklore there and see if you can see, no, nothing coming up. Gila, genitive maybe. It wouldn't be Dila, look up D-I for the L-E, because that would take a shevu after the Maw for so Maw Gila. She looked up D.I. Fidelli. What did it say? A flood. So the place,
plain of the flood.
The place that we were bypassing was called the Floody Floodplain. The point being, the Floody Floodplain. And so, in other words, like if you buy a site, check the name of the town land first. Because if you translate it, it might translate as do not build here.
A piece of information.
So MacGillie was one classic. And then there was another one I came across in my... I love the Vikings. I loved the little light footprint they put on the place names map because they
Scaries.
Didn't... Scaries. There's loads of them.
Yeah. And Dawky.
And they're all seaside ones, have you noticed?
And Tusker or Fastnet.
Yeah, and Tusker as well. Tuscar rock means jagged tooth, which is a brilliant description, but also think Tusk, think Viking, think Arctic Ocean, you know. So, and walruses and all the rest of it. But anyway, we're probably fast-forwarding here. But I remember...
there was one other one.
It's a Viking one. Oh, yeah. Well, what it was, you know, where you see EY at the end.
Oh, yeah.
On an island, like Lambay, Dorsey. Dorsey Island is Bull Island. Lambay is literally Lamb Island. All those islands are all Scotland and Ireland. The Vikings didn't bother trying to colonise us, really. They raided it and they traded it. And they intermarried eventually and some of them settled even. But they weren't here as a conquesting force. They weren't trying to change us. They didn't want to force us to speak Old Norse. They didn't give a damn. If they'd ask you straight up, what's the name of your town, kid? It's called Cork. It's called Cork, lads. Robert. That simple. But where they didn't have a name, they had to create their own names. And that's why so many of our coastal features have Viking names, because there was no one to ask.
Yes.
So Tuscar Rock is one, Fastnet, Dorsey Island, Ireland's Eye. Even the EY there means island again. So literally Ireland's Eye means the island of Ireland. So lads, if you're heading off on a raiding party down the Irish Sea, when you hit this big lump of rock that we call Ireland's Eye, the boys will recognise it. Sharp right there, up the Liffey, raw ball around.
And away you go.
Yeah, give the dubs a good hiding for us. Away you go. And so, but when they settled, and it's amazing because I did this as a separate journey and they all kind of mesh now. Years ago, we traced the source of the Poddle on a TV show many years ago, and we travelled up the Liffey, up the brackish waters, literally in the wake of the Vikings, where the longships would have gone, until we came roughly to where the four courts are today. Straight across the road on the quay wall, there's a huge sluice gate, like a big, huge, rusting gate. And that is where the River Poddle, now was sent underground, emerges from Temple Bar into the River Liffey. So the Vikings, having been at sea for weeks, would have come up, they could have smelt the sweet water, I'd say. So that's why they pitched tent there on what became Wood Quay, what became Dublin eventually.
Well, the Black Pool, the Dublin, which was, and it's marked out in the gardens behind the Dublin Castle there. Like if you actually go in, they mark out the shape of what the Black Pool would have been, which was the Poddle, was it? In the back of Dublin Castle.
Brilliant. So they settled there, an obvious thing to do. They had some, you know, woodcock. They would have had eels, fish, fresh water, hugely important, a bit of raiding and trading. And as they settled there, they set up another trading post further upstream in a place that they called Lakshalup, meaning salmon leap. That's Old Norse for salmon leap. Lakshalup, eventually, as you were talking about bad translations, became Leakslip. And the Irish for Leakslip, if you remember from school, is Leam of Rodain. You'll even see it on the signs there.
Salmon jump.
Yeah, salmon leap. So here's the interesting thing. The original name, given by the Vikings, because they set up the shop there, was Lakshalup. That has given us the English Leakslip. Leakslip means nothing.
Yes.
But at least the Irish name, Leam of Rodain, which doesn't sound like Lakshalup, means the same thing. Salmon leap, leap of the salmon. So, I find the place names fascinating. And so that's where it kind of started for me. But I always had an interest in folklore, and I guess we are living the folklore.
Well, hang on now. Let me pause you there, because we had a thread and it was... that was always in you. The ask from Gil, was it before or after the TV shows?
That was going on for years. In fact, they were talking about fiction.
Sorry, for anyone that doesn't know, Creedence Atlas of Ireland. That was you just doing journeys around. What was the place names one? Is that
Creedence Atlas of Ireland? Yeah.
Was that the place names one?
I specifically said I wanted to do,
because you did. You have done travel journey ones of just kind of like,
and I've done the Wild Atlantic Way, and I've done
a whole bunch of them,
right? But the thing about the writing was, it goes way back. It goes way back. Deirdre Nolan, no longer with Gil, but an absolute sweetheart of a woman, contacted me out of the blue and said, I feel there's a book in you. I listened to your radio show and I think there's a book in you. And I said, I talk for Ireland, but I'm not sure about books. I don't read a lot, to be honest.
And, can I dictate it?
Yeah. Yeah, can I call it out into a mic? And I love the process of hammering it together. And in fact, I know they always say, just get it down.
But I suppose what I'm trying to find out was, like, did the show, did the TV show come before the book?
What happened was that the whole thing about me writing a book was going on for years. Yeah. And I had said to her on a few occasions, I said, dear, I'm not playing hard to get. Yeah. I don't think I'm ready. First of all, I'm way too busy. Number two is, yeah, I think in flashes, I can give you a comedy sketch. I can give you a one-liner. I can give you an observation. Mm. I could probably stretch to doing an 800 or a 1,000 feature on why I love Cork City Football Club so much. yeah, I could do stuff like that. But I'm not a book. I wouldn't know how to arch it or to make it run for 200-400 pages. I don't know if I have anything to say that's long. I know I go on that long, but they're all quick little flash ideas. And she said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, privately, I said, there's a story I'd love to tell. And I said, I think it's fiction. I see it as a movie. It's based on a true story, something that happened to me. I said, I've made some notes. I even polished one or two or three or four little paragraphs. But I said, no, I'm not sure I'm a fiction writer. Yeah. She said, could I see it? And I said, if you promise you don't laugh.
Because there's writing in the family, like.
Yeah, there is, of course.
Conal, hello.
I mean, Conal is a playwright and everything else.
Yeah.
So I'm a storyteller, hands on my hips and telling you about some mad fella I met. But anyway... she said, I won't laugh, let me have a peep. So I let her have a peep, and there were notes to self and one-liners and things that would never emerge in the story anyway. Yeah. And she came straight back and said, we'd love to publish, but what are you going to do for us? And I said, I don't know. Look, can you give me 6 months, because I'm hearing around the country again. Yeah. And whatever it was, it went on genuinely for maybe 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah.
And eventually when she came back and said, look, you know, from your TV work, she said, you waxed lyrical. You seem to get Ireland. You seem to have a grow for the folks and for the people. And I said, I do. I love every blade of grass in the place and every stone. But she said, well, would you do this like a love letter to Ireland? And I said, I'm not sure. Is that too grandiose? I said, look, I said, if I was to kind of focus, and I remember a very clever man, Tommy Healy, in the training department in RT once, he was talking about documentaries, and I gave him some idea about, do you know the guy that tried to shoot the Pope, and the Pope went to give him and see him and went to forgive him? Well, his family, he said, John, if you can't tell me in one line what the doc is about, you ain't got a doc. So I kind of felt the same way. I said, I could be going on forever about Ireland.
Yeah.
I could start now and I could start about...
It needs a prism within which to focus.
So I said, I'm particularly fascinated by place names, and I feel that while I'm not an academic, I might be able to shine a kind of a personal light and say, look at the beauty in this. Mm. Look how, like, any people...
There's a lyricism in it, isn't there? Geez. You know, there's a poetry and there's stories,
I mentioned Tiernan Spadogia to you there. Like, that's a town land outside my father's village. But it's the land of the robins. Now, think about that. Like, to me, that betrays how affectionate or how gentle the people were. Irish is a guttural language, I know, but within it there's such a grow, like even the way animals are named in Irish, you know, Boeing Day, you know, God's little cow is the Irish as for a ladybird.
As Manachán McGann has beautifully illustrated in a book that I have at home.
Absolutely.
And where he takes pleasure in actually the inventiveness around the naming of animals.
I mean, I've always loved animal names particularly, but if you take, like, even take wolf, and a pops up in place names. Like, there is a couple of theories about Ballyvickeira, that it's probably a saint or it's the son.
Is that your dad's village?
No, that's beyond again. That's further west. But I was talking to a man out there once who maintains...
And that's Ballymakeery, for anyone wondering what
is. That's how it was anglicised. Mm. But an elderly man out there once said to me that he believed that the real origin of it was Ballyvickeira, the townland of the wolf, because the Irish term for a wolf is Mochtira, which translates
son
literally...
Son of the land.
No, isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
An old lad from the land. Yeah. There's an affection in that. Yeah, this guy might be tough and he might be dodgy, but at least he is, like, he's respectable in the name, like, son of the land.
Well, you're right. It's almost kind of going, like, leave him alone. He knows what he's doing. He belongs here more than we do.
Exactly. All of those names. In my garden, and I'm living in the city centre, and tiny garden, but I get, like, just an amazing array of wild birds. But the Irish names I love, like, for example, the goldfinch, the small little fella with the red fascine, and he's got a canary coloured yellow feather under his wing, so when he flies you get this, like, flash. And the Irish name for a goldfinch is Lasar Quilla, which means spark or glint or flash of the woods. So,
like, why would you swap that?
Yeah.
You know, as a language, you know, like, why would you swap that for goldfinch?
Another another beauty, and this only came up recently with Art O'Leary, who was the president's right-hand man in Áras an Uachtaráin. He's now involved in the Council of State. But not unlike myself, I only know the man from Twitter. But he tweeted about the Ciara Mhui, which was the name he gave to the goldcrest. Now, the goldcrest, as you know, is a tiny little bird, like a wren, but it's got a yellow comb that stands up on its head. It's got a, the male particularly, has got a real golden little flash up on top of its roof, the roof of its head, like a comb. So Ciara Mhui is yellow comb, and I thought, oh, what a cute name. But I sent him the name I would have for a goldcrest, which is Drolin an Aspig. Drolin is a wren on Aspig of the bishop.
The bishop's wren.
Yeah, because he's got the fancy yellow hat. He's just like a wren, but he's got the little yellow hat. Yeah. So I texted back, I tweeted back to him, and I said, the gold crest is mightier than the... boom, boom, one of my better gags. I should write that down and use it in the next book.
Hang on now, because we've gone a long way and we haven't even linked to the second book. So the first book, That Place We Call Home, was about place names, about which we may well return to. And the publisher said, John, that went great. Let's do more, because... we're in the business of selling books.
The truth of the matter
is... so let's do another one, because that went great.
I finished all the signings now, but I did a couple of kind of storeroom signings around the country, and I was very pleasantly surprised, still am. Maybe I'm a kind of, what's the word for it, not reluctant author. No, I'm really keen as a little boy. All I ever wanted to do was write.
Well, we all have imposter syndrome around everything, don't we? Like, is this really me? Did I really write a book? Like, did me to sign it?
Like the Unpost Awards, the whole thing, I was like a bunny in the headlights, because I'd never even been at the Unpost Awards.
Do you know what's beautiful about it though, John, is because of the profile that you have, you're bringing sort of maybe, esoteric's the wrong word, but stuff that might be of more particular niche or interest to a big wider audience in a very accessible way that allows them to say, oh, that's lovely, or actually then go further into it if they wish to. So like these are lovely things, and these are our things.
In many ways,
the treasury of Irish folklore. So there was a project set out by school kids. The department? I mean,
No. This was something I've always wanted to do. And in fact, on the television series, we dipped in occasionally to this. So I should explain, first of all, what it is.
Yes.
Dúchas are currently digitising this fantastic resource that belongs to all of us. In 1921, shelling of the four courts in the Civil War, the four courts caught fire. The public records office at the back was burned to the ground, and with it went centuries of births, deaths, marriages. We lost a huge amount of the story of us. So you think about the new nation then. We're still in 1935. We're just the Irish Free State. We still haven't become a republic. We're decoupling from England. And bit by bit by bit by bit, we're getting our independence. And we've a very busy, and I think often quite brilliant, group of young men and women who set about setting up this country. It's a shame it went so conservative for about 50 years. But these were visionaries. And amongst them, they set up the Irish Folklore Commission, 1935, and immediately they set up this Balliochán na Scoil, the school's collection. So what they did was they issued 50,000 copybooks to 50,000 sixth class students around the country and said, go out the lanes, talk to the old people, talk to your grandma, talk to your grandpa, go out there and get the story of us and write it down. So they got leprechauns, banshees, St. Patrick, Cúchulainn, the famine, hedge schools, and there are some accounts in these that are just secondhand accounts, but they're of the hedge schools. And there's one lovely one from Clonmel, I think it is, of a man who said, an elderly man who told the child, he said, my own school teacher, he said, was in the hedge school, and he had one of the great monastic books with him that he kept hidden after the after Cromwell, he had dissolution of the churches and all of that. So the point was that for hundreds of years, and I won't kind of pull my punches here, right? Really, the Normans or the Vikings or anybody else, but from Cromwell on, really, they really set about dismantling everything that was Irish, all our customs, our language, our loganimnacha, our place names. You couldn't own a horse, you couldn't carry a sword. There was nothing left to us except words that were usually whispered because we were a beaten people for hundreds of years. But so we didn't develop an opera, we didn't develop a great ballet, we didn't develop a lot of these things. But what we got very good at was talk and words and stories. And so the stories were passed on from, you know, one generation to the next. Like in the opening paragraph there, I point out how my old man was in the car beside me one day and out of the blue, well, not out of the blue, was prompted by seeing a family memorial for a man who talked as much as myself. He went very quiet and I said, "Are you okay, Dad?" He said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "I'm just thinking about the poor people in the famine." And I said, "How do you think they'd feel about us? Would they be pleased with the Celtic Tiger?" This is 20 years ago now. "Do you think they'd be pleased with the way we turned out with the Celtic Tiger and independence and everything else?" And my dad was not into theories, only stories. So he said, "Geez, I'd know nothing about that." He said, "But I knew a man who was in the famine." I said, "Dad, no, you didn't." I said, "The famine was 150 years ago. "Well, I'm telling you now." He said, "I knew a man who was in the famine." And I said, "Go on." "No, he was born in 1919, my dad was. Yeah. As he said himself, I skidded to a halt on the lino above in that room there," he said. And he said, "When I gathered my senses, I had one good look around me and I said, Inchigila. Thank you, God. Thank you." Anyway, there was a man.
I knew that's where you were
there
from.
There was a
actually.
Man with a sense of place. But anyway, he said that this elderly gentleman out in Glengariff was on the itinerary of my grandfather's Model T truck delivering meal around West Cork. And he said, "I used to travel when I was a small boy, 4, 5, 6 years of age, for the spin with Dennis Lucy, our driver, delivering meal out around West Cork." And he said there was an elderly man called O'Sullivan in Glengariff who lived well into his 90s and who told us not once, but several times, that during the famine he was a little boy and there was a crib, the ambulance as they called it, from Bantry Workhouse was collecting the dead and the dying, and it had stopped in Glengariff. And he said, "I went skipping down the street with some other children, and even though I was only a small little child, I poked a sally rod in at what I thought was a dead body, but the man was alive and he brushed me away. And even though I was only a baby, a small boy at the time, it's to my immortal shame that I ever did such a terrible thing." And I said, "You never told me." And he said, "You never asked me." So I'm doing the maths and I'm thinking, if my dad was born in 1919 and this man lived to be 90 and he was telling my dad this in 1925, geez, there's several years.
Your dad was six and your man maybe is, let's say he's 85.
Yeah, listen, there's a span of about 15 years.
He needed to be more than 85.
Yeah.
That'd be 1840 he would have been born in. So what do you reckon? Oh, that could have been
yeah,
it.
Yeah, if he was born in 1840, by 1920, he would have been 80.
Yeah.
He'd have been 80. Yeah. So if he was 84, 85 and told my dad this, he still had another 6 years to go. He was probably telling the story up to 1930. Yeah. So the point is...
Living memory of the family.
So the man sitting beside me in the car, and that was all prompted by my bringing my dad out to see John Behan's family memorial in Westport. Mm. And it got him thinking. And it brought back that memory. So I used that story, and it's a true story, partly to tee up the whole book, which is the moral of the story is to ask. Mm. It's not even about writing down folklore. It's called Béal Idis. It's mouth instruction. Mm. And Idis is a term that's still used in the Gaeltacht for a prescription. Mm. So Béal Idis is the Irish word for folklore. In effect, it means is mouth instruction. You're learning at the knee. So when your grandma or your grandpa or your dad or me is repeating myself and telling the same old stories over and over and over again, mm. our duty is not to write them down. That's literature. Mm. Our duty is to listen. Mm. And you can change the story. You can forget whether it was McCroom or Rylan it happened. You can put your own name into the story. It doesn't matter. Mm. Within the story, there's a kernel of a truth or a moral tale or something like that.
An Aesop's fable of sorts. You mentioned about, you know, we didn't develop an opera and we didn't develop this. What we were good at talking was, and I agree with you, but I think through the ages, because, you know, the filler was so important in Irish society, and, you know, to have a satire written about you or against you, you know, was, so, and they had a high place in the system, in the court, did the poet.
Yeah. You're talking Mary Rosenstock now here, are you?
There you go.
You see, it's never gone away.
Yeah, it's never gone away.
It's never gone away.
And that is how how the mighty can fall.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But that storytelling, that aspect, and that use of words is central to us.
Let me give you another little story that my father told me. And again, there is there's something of value in it, right? He told me about this elderly woman called Mag Lorden, who, as he said, was like a bag lady. He said she had a home once, but it was burnt down. But she was usually found wandering around in Chigila with her bags. Mm. And he said, but Mag, he said, used to sit on the bridge in Chigila. This is on the road west now towards Gugan. Mm. And that would have been part of the grand tour for a lot of Victorians. Mm. They would have come into Cork and they would have gone out to Gugan, Glengariff, Kinmare, mm. you know, on that route. And he
down
said
to the lakes,
yeah, and the Sharabanks bringing, you know, tourists used to go past over that bridge. And he said Mag used to sit down on the bridge there and throw looking for coppers off the Sharabanks mm. going past. And one day, she said, my father told me Lord Halsey, who there were the people who had Whiddy Island and a lot of that mm. out there, big landowners, was trotting past on his horse, and he was wearing a coat and a top hat and everything else, and she started praising him as he approached, hoping he'd throw her a few coppers. Oh, Lord Halsey, that I was only saying last week, what a fine... I probably sound just like her now with the croaky voice and everything else. What a fine figure you cut with your beautiful steed and your lovely frock coat. And she'd hand out, you might throw me down a few coppers. And he brushed past with the riding crop and said, out of my way, Mag.
Yeah.
And she said, as he trotted away, she shouted after him, that I was only saying that last week, but you look what you know with your jaw. Oh, hanging to you like a genius. Now, my father said, apart from her being smart, he says, think about that, he said. That woman praised him in the past tense, which afforded her the opportunity to slag him off in the present or the future. And he said, that's coming from a people, he said, who were uneducated. My father said to me, he said, in a time when you were not allowed to carry a sword and the sharpest weapon you could carry was your tongue, you kept it well sharpened. And the Irish, boy, I tell you, were well able to dole it out.
I know that I'm limited time with you and we're almost up with it. That Place We Call Home was the first book. The new one is The Treasury of Irish Folklore. It's the compilation. Well, it's your look through some of what's contained in that treasure trove
yeah.
that was gathered in the 30s in the nascent new Irish state. I mean, you know, Lady Gregory went out in the 1880s to find the heroic stories of Cuchulainn and the like that in many respects had been forgotten. And we'll credit the Anglo-Irish for recognising that something was going to be lost. And
They weren't all bad, and there are a few fabulous accounts aside in the Irish Folklore Treasury of good landlords. There was one account there from Derry of...
Well, Parnell did quite an amount for us, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. But one man who literally cashed in all his chips to try and save the bacon off his poor tenants. And we must remember as well that a huge part of Protestantism that really probably, maybe it does permeate the Catholic Church as well, but that whole notion of noblesse oblige, it's because we're educated, it's because we're well off, that we have a duty to educate or support. Now, I know some people
The Quakers.
Yeah, the Quakers were remarkable. Mm.
Their whole ethic is to... Yeah.
I'm a church-going nothing, but if I ever go back to church, I think it's Quakering I'll take up, because they were really and truly beautiful, non-judgmental people. You know?
What I wanted to ask you in the limited time that I have left with you is actually about Muskerry and Inchigeela, and that is the heart of the Gaeltacht. Is it the Ivy Leary? Is it the home...
Yeah,
Ivy Leara. So tell me a bit about Ivy Leara and Muskerry and what you know. Like, what is Muskerry? Is it like Kerry? I mean, Kerry is...
Muskerry is the barony, and Ivy Leara is actually the parish, and it includes a number of small villages. Now, I grew up in Cork City Centre, smack bang in the middle of it.
But the roots.
Yeah, and in fact, that's a wonderful thing. I did a two-year diploma up in UCC, and I remember Professor Garrod O'Cruley asked us to do a paper on, and here was the subject, is there a folk in the city? 5,000 words. I went, what? Is there a folk in the city? What does that mean? The point being that people often assume that folklore is about chickens and farmyards and stuff. No. Following Cork City FC is part of the folklore. Mm. That's a subculture. Mm. Why? What's that about?
The Arcadia. The downtown campus.
But even take Cork City, right? I mean, that, you know, sometimes it's dismissed as the garrison game. Yeah, it is the garrison game. Unashamedly, the garrison game. There were people who came in here. I expect the blood of Vikings and Normans and possibly English run of my bloods, my mother, all of our bloods. So the point is that they're all part of the story, and that's one of the reasons why I really feel, but back to the place names for a moment, that going forward it's now our turn to name places. And I think we made a bags of it. Well, we didn't. We told our story in the Celtic Tiger years. we were full of ourselves. Bel Air Heights and forget it. Yeah. Don't. You might insult someone.
Yeah, it's true.
But now here's our opportunity for us to name as we go on. Mm. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be lovely, for example, or what would be wrong with a bungalow called Unfolonine, Little Poland? Mm. Or the next time we open a public space, maybe a little park, that we would name it, we would commemorate, say, all the Filipino nurses and doctors, some of whom died during the pandemic of 2020, 2022 or whatever, and call it Manila Park. Mm. And people in the future will say, Manila Park, isn't that in the Philippines? Mm. Yeah, but back in the 1990s and into the 2000s, a lot of Filipinos came to Ireland, and you know what I mean?
And to tie that, Shalom Park,
yeah,
recognises the Lithuanian Jews
Town, as it was called,
stopped off in Cork for a period of time.
Yeah.
What did your mention there throw up for me?
Evelera
and Muskerry. But I see a Cork Fremount hurling story popping up out of your... Is there a volunteer one then behind
No, that was actually a note to self. I'm sorry, I was holding that up, but I wasn't pointing it
out. There are little Cork elements of what's in this book, so why don't we finish on one or two of those little bits?
Sure. There's a couple of beauties in there. One very tragic one, really. It broke my heart, to be honest. It is, it's from Bantir, and Master Sheehan was the headmaster in the school, and a local man was sent running. This is an account now from an elderly man to a child in 1937. And he said when he was a small boy, Master Sheehan let them off class to go out onto the height and to watch the redcoats below evicting people. So these children were, it was almost a treat to watch the colour and excitement of the redcoats throwing people out of their houses. So I often think trauma, it comes from the Greek word, a wound. If you wonder what's wrong with us, what's wrong with the Irish, why are we so cross about that? Why are we so touched? Well, one of the things that struck me was, like, we were a traumatised people. So those children, even to witness someone else being traumatised, is to be traumatised yourself. Mm. But that description, a very matter-of-fact description of the redcoats throwing people out of their homes and the children being let out of class to see it happening. There was another amazing one in there, which I thought was absolutely kind of staggering in terms of our story. Like, for example, if you went as far as putting a window in your cottage for hundreds of years in this country, you were taxed on it. Mm. So if you want to understand, people whinge about the poor farmer and the poor mouth and all that. You need to understand it. When you see some of these stories, you see that these people were battered for centuries. If they showed any sign of improvement, they were battered again. Mm. So keep your cards close to your chest, say nothing, build the extension, hopefully you'll get planning for it later. You know, all this kind of stuff.
Don't talk in straight lines, talk in circles.
It comes from years of trying to survive. Mm. And there's another lovely story in there from Fremont, and I just thought it was amazing. It was about a hurling match, as described by an elderly gentleman to a little boy.
So again, just remind me exactly, it's young kids that are being sent
in 1937 but the account is brilliant. He was talking to Dennis, and Dennis told me that this is long before, remember, the GAA was the 1880s when we had a Caidón and it was standardised. So up to then it was house rules, not unlike football in England. You had a row where you had the association went one direction and rugby school and others went the rugby direction. Here you had different forms of hurling in different parts of the country. A lot of the northern counties walked out from the GAA meetings up in Hayes's Hotel in Thurles and said, no, you're adopting Munster rules, we want to a fair crack at the whip. So that's why to this day, within 100 miles of Hayes's Hotel, Kilkenny, Tipperary, Wexford, Waterford, East Cork, Limerick, Clare, that's where hurling is still strong. So
because it was the Munster rules that won the day.
Exactly.
That was the first hurling battle.
So this account is pre-GAA.
Yeah.
It's a hurling match up in Fremont, and the lads who went up after a mass to play them, they'd normally play about 50 a side, no goalposts, no referee, no sidelines. The slitter was very similar to what it is now anyway. That's the only thing that didn't change.
And
a match would last up to 6 hours and usually would end with a good beating by both teams. A physical fist fighting beating. And I thought, at least one thing hasn't changed, right?
But what do you know what the goal was? Like, how did you win?
Oh, yeah, over the other person's fence. And most scores, I think it said, most matches would finish with about 20 goals each. But it took a lot of effort, 6 hours to get 20 goals. There was a fair bit of flaking and rooting.
And I'd say they didn't wait to 6 hours to have the fight either. I'd say there was plenty of it going along the way.
Brilliant, hardy boys.
Jeez.
But do you know something? But what's amazing is when you get it, admittedly it's second hand. It's the children are getting this. And in some cases, a lot of the stories are very funny. There's everything in there. There's wit, there's wisdom, there's old recipes.
Sadness and...
Yeah, and you can see the connection with the animals.
Is there much romance in there?
Well, one of the things I discovered is that they were very very tight on getting married in Lent, during Lent. That just didn't happen. But there was a loophole, as explained in the book, Skellig Sunday.
That's right.
Yeah, you've heard of it?
Yeah, I did a chat in a previous podcast about Skellig Night.
Yeah, and there's an awful lot of stuff in here that was lost to us. And now when you read it, you go, that makes perfect sense. That's exactly what alternative medicine says now. Yeah. So, like, I was talking there about cures and I was saying something like that. We now have complementary medicine and Western medicine, or whatever it's called, traditional medicine, working side by side. You go to the acupuncturist, you go to your GP, you go to your, you know, massage therapist, you go to your surgeon. There's a mix and match in people. But back then it was ever thus. It was always a rub of the relic, a flat 7-up, the doctor, the band Fassa, people like... Billy Early, she was one of many women who were thought to have it. And the interesting thing about the cure, having the gift of the cure, like, some of these things seem very far-fetched. And then, like I did, I went off down to, I'm sorry, I'm fast-forwarding here now, but I went off down to Ballinspittle, because the Irish is Béalach an Spidéal, the mouth of the river of the hospital. Now, hospital in a very general sense, basically, was an isolation area where people who were infected would be put. We have them in Cork as well. Yeah. Lover's Walk, believe it or not, is Lower, L-O-B-H-A-R.
That's right.
Meaning leper's walk. Mm. So if you were infected, you were sent off down towards the Dunkettle roundabout and you were kept out of the city because there was no penicillin back then. So similarly, Béalach an Spidéal was full of holy wells and there was a holding area there for people who were infectious. So that's how I got the name Béalach an Spidéal. But it's full of holy wells. I went down with Luke O'Neill, Professor Luke O'Neill, and Ardal O'Hanlon, don't ask me why, an unlikely trio, to examine, was there any science to back the sacred understanding of the wells? And Luke O'Neill came up with trumps. He said, yeah, there is. He says, that one is very high in copper. That is very high. Good. We've tested it. Yeah. That's very good for our rheumatism, for this, that and the other. Another one was a chalybeate well, which meant it was very high in iron. So... And I said, but how do people know? He said, John, observation. You don't need a white coat to realise that when Dad washes himself below in the lower field, his skin improves hugely, whatever was wrong with him. Or have you noticed how the cattle above at that well...
Observation.
Yeah, the cattle above at that well seem to thrive. Yeah. But the crowd below on Murphy's well, Jesus, the cattle are starving, you know?
Sometimes there's a simplicity in life. If you actually just spend some time looking at stuff, you can figure out a lot.
Time, what
like,
the...
You know, people say they're very bad, they're not great with plants, and I'm like, you just have to look at them.
Yeah.
You just have to look at them and think about it for a little bit and it'll tell you what's wrong.
It's the same observation. With the folklore. People don't realise we're actually living the folklore anyway.
Yeah. I just wanted to reference it because it was Kieran Connolly. I had a chat with him. He wrote the book Sam Maguire, The Man and the Cup. So I had a chat with him about the Holy Trinity of Cork GAA, which was Archbishop Croke was a born Cork man, for whom Croke Park is named. Sam Maguire, obviously born in Dunmanway, and Liam McCarthy was his parents emigrated from the famine from Ballygarvan to London. He swore in Michael Collins into the IRB and possibly some other notable figures as well. But so it was Liam McCarthy, Sam Maguire and Archbishop Croke, the Holy Trinity GA. And I had a chat with Kieran about that and he came back for another chat and that chat was the story behind Skellig Night, which was Shrove Tuesday.
Brilliant.
And Bonner Night, St. John's Eve. Anyone has listened to this, you can dig back into a past podcast to hear more about that.
But funny, those three big names you mentioned from the GA, that's just our full back line. You then start moving up the field and you bring on your Jimmy Barry Murphys and your Christy Rings and then we've produced a few beauties along the way. And I mean, that's wonderful. I mean, like, it's even I often think, like, with hurling, and as you know, I'm a huge League of Ireland man. I've great graph for the hurling as well. It's just such a sweet, sweet, beautiful, subtle game, flicking a wrist, you know yourself. And I often think sometimes maybe that organisations get in the way of the beauty. It's a bit like sometimes maybe the Vatican gets in the way of what Jesus was saying, which was, hey, you're grand the way you are. I love you the way you are. Just be kind to people, do the best you can. You mess up, no problem. Still love you. That was the message, the core message. And all of a sudden, someone tries to brand it and copyright it and say it's ours. And maybe to a certain degree, sometimes with the FAI or the RFU or the GAA, sometimes it's the lads with the blazers and the laminates who actually give the thing a bad name. But when you look at the poetry of the pure game, you know, a wet pitch, a wet slitter, you know, a dead slitter and whizzing through the sky, you know, the ash plant with a good whip in it, and a forest of hurleys going up and one hand rises above them all and makes a clean snatch and drops, whether it be a boy or a girl, you know, and, you know, shortens the hurley and flick over their shoulders and sails between the... Like, there's a poetry, there's a beauty to that that's going on all over the county. like as we speak. That's part of the folklore.
And it, and you bring it back to well, not to him, but like it's back there in our ancient folklore and myth stories of Cúchulainn, and you know, hurling goes that far back into our
absolutely.
And here it is with us today. I guess is the point you're making.
Yeah,
is
that I mean, even as you drive,
the past is not the past.
Even as you drive around Cork today, there are labels everywhere saying hello. Like, you know, as I was saying, Umvar Avenue is actually, or Pictoujar Park. I mean, these are amazing places. You look at a Toker. Toker is an interesting one.
Toll Road.
Well, no. My understanding would be a Toker, T-O-C-H-A-R. It would be a raised road. So it could be like across a very boggy area where you have a raised road, or it could even be a defensive ditch. Okay. And around the country, that was anglicised, as it was here, from T-O-C-H-A-R, the origin, to T-O-G-H-E-R.
Yes.
So around
we have one in Louth, and it's Toher.
I knew it. I guessed it. They have them in Kildare. There's Toher Oil.
Yeah.
But in Cork, even though we spell it in the English, people who don't have one word of Irish.
I always wondered why I was Toker.
People who don't have one word of Irish,
they
spell
it
in the English, but they pronounce it in the Irish. They call it Toker, because that's what it is. And that was like a ring road before the ring road.
Yeah.
That was a defensive ditch, as I understood it, that ran out around there through Lehenamore and all that. But, you know, ask yourself, why
Even a more obvious one. Kirky Mornamoon.
Yeah, brilliant.
The Great Marsh of Munster.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you realise, oh, wow, this city was built on... Actually, nowadays, you wouldn't get planning for it. It would be a natural, it would be a wildlife habitat.
As the poet Theodorgan said to me once, he said, as much as I love it, it was a dumb place to build a city.
John Green, let's finish on that.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you very
You're
much. The Place We Call Home was the first book, and the new one is A Treasury of Irish Folklore, selling out across the land as we speak. Thanks for the chats and being part of this Cork History Matters podcast.
For more Red FM podcasts, go to redfm.ie/podcasts.